This is The Guardian.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Any forward progress in technology involves some rational assumption of risk. And the way Google is thinking about that is, okay, how do we proceed both boldly and responsibly? Because the promise of these technologies is just so overwhelming.
Google's chief privacy officer, Keith Enright, talking about their approach to AI and privacy.
Take On Tomorrow from PwC's Strategy and Business. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
We can't risk having a very large Labour majority, a so-called supermajority.
We are the challengers to Labour. We are now the real opposition.
And I just warn people, I do not give the matches back to the arsonist to finish the job.
Labour Manifesto 2024. There's simply no money there. What you have baked in there is substantial austerity.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
We're sitting here in the Houses of Parliament and several hundred miles away in Merthyr Tydfil, sort of Labour heartland, really, in South Wales. Nigel Farage is launching what he's describing as his contract with the people, Kieran, although I think we'll just call it a manifesto.
Yeah, he doesn't like that word.
That's what it is. And we know already a little bit about what he's planning to do, what the Reform UK would plan to do from press conferences and from interviews that he's done in recent days and weeks. And there are things like cutting NHS waiting lists, no surprise there, but he says to zero in 2 years, which obviously, given they're currently about 7.6 million, I think they're at, aren't they? That would be pretty tricky to do. And actually, I think a lot of the focus would be in things like he has suggested having a French-style healthcare system, which is insurance-based. But I guess the suspicion a lot of people will have is that actually that's just a start. And ultimately, he would want some sort of private insurance, US-style basis for the NHS, which obviously would go really against the sort of founding principles of the NHS being free for everyone at the point of need. So, but we're going to be kicking the tires on some of those policies, aren't we?
It's always difficult as journalists, isn't it, to know how to cover a manifesto of a party that's not going to make it into government. So, yes, well, of course, we have to kick the tires on these policy commitments. But then you slightly suspect that Reform supporters don't really care at the moment. They're not voting for Reform, or they're not saying they're going to vote for Reform because of a great suite of Reform policies. And in fact, I remember covering UKIP in the early-ish days of UKIP, where they had a huge manifesto of all sorts of different things. I remember it said one thing was that they would change the uniforms of train drivers back to be a more traditional colour that they used to wear under the British Rail days. And one of the things Nigel Farage realised when he then took over the party once again is that people are not paying attention to this. And these are more banana skins than anything else, which is, I think, another reason he doesn't like using the word manifesto, because he doesn't really want to be held accountable. But I think what you do get a good way to examine documents like this is to show you what kind of voter they're hoping to go after and what kind of election appeal they have. So we talk about things like adopting an insurance-based healthcare model, which is fairly traditional libertarian right. But then at the same time, they talk about nationalising utilities companies, which are very economically left. And that's because they have this really interesting but very diverse coalition of voters that they're trying to appeal to. And where Farage, I think, has been successful in the past is marrying the social conservatism and the pro-Brexitism with actually a relatively left-wing, or maybe left-wing isn't quite the right word, but sometimes relatively statist economic set of policies. Mm-hmm. None of these really tie together necessarily, but then their voters don't really expect them to.
But when the Lib Dems produced their manifesto, I mean, I went along to a breakfast with Ed Davey to examine whether it was actually, you know, the plans stacked up fiscally, and whether they published their costings. And we all asked lots of questions about and tried to interrogate whether actually these were credible and could be delivered in government, not least, of course, because Lib Dems in 2010 did surprise us all by ending up as coalition partners, but also because what we have found with smaller parties like the Lib Dems is that they can influence the policy positions of the bigger parties. And I think we're likely to see that post-election with Reform, if it remains some sort of political force, and the impact it has on the Conservatives, not least on policies like immigration, where they will be pushing the Conservative Party to go further to the right. And that's actually why I think it is important for us to properly analyse each of these policies and to see whether they're credible. I mean, they've been described as, you know, Liz Truss mini-budget on stilts. And look at the reaction of the Liz Truss mini-budget. Not because we expect to see Nigel Farage walking through the door of Downing Street or even leading the opposition straight after the election, but because the policies that are spelt out here will potentially have an impact on what happens next on the future direction of the Conservative Party, for which, of course, he's been a huge thorn in the side in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, he has. And do you know what? I'm starting to detect a bit of a shift among Conservatives about how they approach him, because I think until now, there's been a reluctance to really go after Farage and really go after Reform, to the extent that you've been hearing rumours about, well, in fact, he's talked about it openly, the chance that he might then defect after the election and try and stand to be Tory leader.
If they let him.
Well, but that's what I'm detecting is changing. I really don't see now that a Conservative Party after the election, almost no matter who comes back for it, will actually let him get back in. Mm-hmm. You know, the way he's gone after their voters, obviously there was no electoral pact this time around, so he could do huge damage to the party. And I think the Conservatives are realising that Nigel Farage is not their friend and that he does actually want to destroy the Conservative Party, or at least change it beyond all recognition.
I mean, we should probably just say that this comes after a poll at the end of last week where Reform overtook the Tories for the first time. It was a YouGov poll. It put Reform UK on 19% ahead of the Conservatives on 18%, which is very much in the margins of error when it comes to polling. And it should be said that Labour remained far ahead of both parties on 37%, and subsequent polls since that initial one have had a much bigger gap between Reform and the Conservatives. But I think you're right that there is a sort of a difference. Initially, it felt like they didn't want to criticise Farage at all. And then you've had some big voices, like Kemi Badenoch, come out and say, look, basically, as you've just said, Nigel Farage is not your friend. We don't want him. He's out to destroy the Conservative Party. And then over the weekend, David Cameron, the Foreign Secretary, accused him of being incredibly divisive in his language on immigration. He said, don't forget, Enoch Powell stopped Britain talking about immigration for 20 to 30 years. I think with these populists, what you get is inflammatory language and hopeless policy. Now, it does represent a shift in approach, I think, towards Reform. But I also think that David Cameron in particular needs to be careful, because he represents to many people, to many voters, the sort of like the patrician elite wing of the Conservative Party. This was sort of like epitomised with the Brexit referendum when he complacently led the Remain campaign, as some saw it, to defeat, assuming that things would go his way because they always had done. And yet, of course, Brexit won. And that was in no small part to, you know, Farage pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing for Cameron to hold a referendum in the first place. And I think that a lot of Reform voters do regard some parts of the Conservative Party as a bit out of touch and elitist and not representing their views, particularly with the cost of living. And Farage is very smart at trying to capitalise on that. So I think the Conservative attacks of that ilk, they're going to have to be a little bit careful.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I'm going to watch out for over the next few days is how much Labour now start to turning their fire on Reform, because I think it has now dawned on the Labour Party over the last, really only the last 4 or 5 days, that Reform are eating into their vote share as well. Now, it's probably, pollsters tell me it's roughly 2-1 at the moment, that for every 2 Conservatives who leave to Reform, 1 Labour voter is leaving to Reform. But that's not insignificant. And while it might get them through this election, in fact, it will help them at this election, that possibly stores up a very serious long-term problem for Labour. And I think one of the things they've got to watch out for is what James Kanagasorium described, he's a pollster, described as having a sandcastle after the election that just gets washed away very quickly by the tide.
Yeah, his suggestion, of course, was that Labour vote was quite shallow, even though it was much more efficient and sort of spread across parts of the country. That means that they will potentially get a quite healthy majority, that it's not based on any sort of great depth or love or support for the Labour Party. And they need to be able to solidify, to turn that sand into cement, really, sooner rather than later. And I did speak to a few Labour strategists over the last few days, and they are conscious of the Farage threat. And, you know, I think immediately after the election, the impact that Farage would potentially play when it comes to shaping the opposition, not necessarily in a formal sense that he's, you know, back in the Conservative Party and is attempting to run it, but in sort of the policy direction that we're talking about. And the rise of populism more generally, it's not just, of course, what's happening in the UK. If Labour win the election, they're going to be looking over the channel and sort of watching the rise of the far-right populists in France. And then, of course, the other way, over the Atlantic, looking towards what happens in the US elections and the potential return of the populist king, Donald Trump.
Yeah, all of which makes it even more interesting then that Rachel Reeves this morning has come out and done an interview in which she has decided to talk about the one thing that I thought Labour was not going to talk about during the whole election, which is our relations with the EU. So she's done an interview with the FT. And actually, if you look at the policy, she's talking about having an agreement, particularly on chemicals. That's her big thing. But in a way, it's not the policy that's interesting here. For me, it's the fact that she's even going there in the first place. I thought Labour were going to spend the entire campaign trying not to talk about Brexit. But here she is all over the front page of the FT talking about exactly that and how Labour wants closer relations with the EU.
See, I interviewed Keir Starmer last week, and one of my questions to him was, why are you scared about, or you know, are you scared of talking about Brexit? No one's talking about it. And he said, well, you know, you're here now, you can ask me the question. And of course I did. And he spelt out their sort of their line, if you like, that they want a closer, better relationship with the European Union. Interestingly, today he's out on the South Coast and he was doing a Q&A with workers late morning, and he was asked specifically about Brexit, and he made the point that in his mind, Boris Johnson screwed up the Brexit deal and he could have done much better. And we know that they want a reformed trading arrangement, and we know they want a closer defence and security arrangement. And I do think it's going to be really interesting because they haven't, you're right, they haven't really been interrogated on this particularly in the course of the election campaign. And I wonder in the, you know, we're almost two thirds of the way through, aren't we? We've only got sort of another couple of weeks until polling day. Whether with the rise of Farage, whether that sort of focus will come back onto Labour and its position on Brexit, and whether they're going to be able to kind of draw a line under and say, no, this is what we said, we're not reopening up this particular Pandora's box for this election, and whether people will believe that.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, what Labour has said is that they don't want to re-enter the customs union. They certainly don't want to have any kind of free movement, and even rejected the idea of a youth mobility scheme recently. But what I'm told is that the Foreign Office is preparing for a series of trade arrangements in various different sectors that would essentially try and recreate the customs union without doing that all in one go. And I suspect that's what Labour is going to try and do, just bit by bit, try and eat back into that territory. And frankly, they will have to, because if any of their promises on growth are going to come about, they will have to have fewer trading barriers between us and our major trading partners.
But a very difficult political path for them to tread, given everything that's happened over the last few years with Brexit and how divisive it's been and how explosive it was for the Labour Party in particular at the 2019 election. And Starmer's also facing other pressure, isn't he? We're once again come back this weekend to the two-child benefit cap. And it's increasingly becoming a sort of a totemic issue, actually, this campaign. Labour had said several months ago that they weren't going to get rid of the cap because they couldn't afford it. And around about that time, in conversations I was having with Labour people, they were suggesting, actually, if you're going to review the government's approach to child poverty, which is one of the things they said they would do in, you know, fairly quickly on taking power, should they win, then there might actually be other ways that are better at addressing child poverty than lifting the cap. And there's been more research out today by the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which finds that when fully rolled out, the policy will affect one in five children, costing families an average of £4,300 a year, or 10% of their income. That's obviously amongst the poorest fifth of households. 38% of those will be affected. So, you know, particularly at a point where so many people have been feeling the pinch, this particular policy seems to be one which is inflicting quite a lot of pain. And it's become a real sort of marker within the Labour movement about whether this is actually a Labour government which ultimately at its heart wants to not just create wealth but support the poorest. And we've had a lot up from Starmer in the last week or so about, you know, the priority, the number one priority is creating wealth, because he then argues, of course, that then leads to boosted growth and that benefits everybody. But that's not going to be a quick or an easy process. And there's a lot of concern within the Labour movement. And actually, I should say beyond it, I was chatting to a friend that votes Tory last week who said to me, Tory/swing voter, I should say, who said to me they were considering voting Labour this time, but they couldn't do it if they didn't lift the two-child benefit cap because they saw it as so pernicious that if a Labour government isn't going to sort this out, then what are they going to do? So I do think it's going to be a problem for them. I do wonder whether when we were writing about what was going to be in the Labour Party manifesto and lots of conversations with people across the Labour movement who suggested that we might end up seeing something like, well, you know, we're not going to lift it for now, but sort of warm words about it being an ambition or an aspiration. That didn't happen in the manifesto. But it really wouldn't surprise me if when they first came in, they made it clear that actually this wasn't something they could afford right now, but this was going to be a priority. They would find a way of lifting that cap so that families who are really on the breadline in many cases had that little bit more wriggle room.
Right. And what would it cost? It's about $1.5 billion, I think, to get rid of the cap. That is the kind of money you can raise in a budget without too much pain. And I think it is interesting that Rachel Reeves continues to hold the line that they're not going to rule out any kind of rise in council tax or in capital gains tax.
She's the Iron Chancellor, the Iron Shadow Chancellor, isn't she? That's what she wants to be if she becomes, she would be Britain's first woman chancellor as well.
From what I can tell about her, once she's made her mind up, it's very difficult to shift her. And there must be a reason that she is not going down the road of ruling out, when she's ruled out income tax, VAT, national insurance, why not CGT, why not other things? They clearly want to have bits of extra money so that they can, you know, they can have a few surprises in their first budget, which we're expecting, I think, in the autumn.
But of course, before they get to that point, they need to win the election. And there's been very much a shift in strategy, not just as we've already discussed in their approach to reform, but more broadly for the Conservatives, with all these warnings about a supermajority and some analysis of Tory adverts on Facebook and, you know, online. Their digital campaign has found that about 90% of those in our attack ads against Starmer specifically, but against the Labour Party, whereas on the Labour side, it's much more about, look, this is what we would do in government, sort of positive vision of their policies and so on, as well as obviously some Tory attacks. And there was a very striking moment this morning when Grant Shapps, the Defence Secretary, who's seen as being one of the Tories' safest pairs of hands when it comes to media, the media around, he always gets sent out when things are looking a bit sticky. He became the first minister to publicly acknowledge that the Tories are unlikely to win the election. I'll just read you out what he said. He said, "It is possible to win the election. Do I accept it's not the most likely outcome? Yes, I accept that. I'm a realist." And while that is something that cabinet ministers have been saying, frankly, for weeks privately, for him to say it publicly, I think, is an interesting shift. And I think he'd probably be the first of many that say that. It also feels like, I mean, you could dismiss it as a desperate strategy, but it does feel like the Tories are recognising they don't have many tools left in their box and they need to deploy ones that they can. And this idea of a supermajority where Labour would basically have such a huge majority that they would be unopposed effectively and there'd be nobody properly holding them to account, I think they're trying to send a message to people who are core Conservative voters, really, but perhaps maybe we're going to stay home this time or even consider voting for reform, and saying to them, look, you need to back us because we need to provide a proper opposition. Because they know that it's almost like Project Fear. They know that the one thing that would unite those voters is not by any means any sort of huge love or even like for the Conservatives right now, but is a fear of seeing Keir Starmer and, in their minds, I guess, a socialist government, you know, moving forward unopposed and be able to do whatever they like because of that huge majority to the country.
When they started doing this, well, first of all, I should say that from what I'm told, they were always planning to launch this kind of attack. The campaign was always going to turn this way if the polls didn't shift, but the plan was to do it much later. You know, we've only got 3 weeks left, but maybe a week or two later, this was going to be a kind of final last ditch attempt to rally the troops. And they've had to bring it forward because, you know, the polls really haven't shifted at all. And when I first started hearing Tories talk about, you know, supermajority and Labour heading for power, I couldn't quite figure out what the strategy was. It felt just so defeatist with still 3 weeks left to go.
2 weeks, Kieran.
Two and a half, are we?
it's getting close anyway. It's getting closer. The clock is ticking.
I remember talking to you about this, and you said that actually some Labour politicians had deployed similar tactics in 2017 when it looked like Labour were going to crash and burn. And privately, some, especially the kind of the right of the Labour Party, the more centrist faction, were going around on the doorstep saying to people, look, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's not going to be Prime Minister, but you don't want the Conservative, you don't want that awful Theresa May to have a huge majority. So come on, you know, lend me your vote.
And it was effective then, right? It was much closer than any of us expected, and they ended up in a hung parliament and you know, a bit of a mess for Theresa May then to inherit. And I think you're absolutely right. I think we will be hearing of Conservative candidates, we will be seeing it when we're out on the doorsteps with them, saying to people on the doorstep, look, I know you're fed up with us, I know you don't want us back in, we get that. But also, look at the other lot. Do you really want them to be unassailed? Do you really want them to be able to do whatever the hell they like? And I think that will press a few buttons with people.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. Look, their strategy has been dubbed the 30% strategy. You know, get the base out. And at the moment, with Labour looking like they're heading for such a huge majority, yeah, that completely makes sense to do exactly that.
Now, there's no such thing in election campaign as a quiet week, Kieran, but last week was a particularly busy one with all the manifestos, and I worked out I went to about six different parts of the UK over the course of about 5 days. This week will be slightly calmer, but there's still a few things coming up. I'll be tuning in on Thursday night to BBC's special Question Time edition, which is going to have Fiona Bruce asking questions, or audience questions, of all four of the main party leaders, so Keir Starmer, Rishi Sunak, Stephen Flynn, who's the SNP's Westminster leader, and the Lib Dem leader, Ed Davey. Unfortunately, there's an all-male lineup, actually, but there we go. And it will, I mean, I think this will be an interesting one, because of those four, Stephen Flynn is definitely the punchiest, and I think he will not hold back in landing blows on pretty much all of the others. So it should be quite a lively one, so I'll be tuning in for that.
Yeah, my prediction is Stephen Flynn will wipe the floor with the rest of them. That is a format that will suit him down to the ground, because he loves to put particularly Labour and the Tories in the same bracket. And he will, in the same way that Nick Clegg, of course, famously did during those debates in 2010, be able to kind of stand to one side and say, they're all the same, here's something different. And I'm sure he'll do that constantly. I mean, Ed Davey could also spring a surprise, but Stephen
Flynn... Like water slide or...
yeah, maybe I'd like to see how he enters the room.
Bouncy castle.
That would be great.
On a trampoline, maybe.
Well, look, that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday with a special episode from the campaign trail in Chingford and Woodford Green. Today in Focus Election Extra, we'll be covering the Reform Manifesto in full. And also a quick reminder to listeners that Google Podcasts is closing. So if you use that platform, please shift to another one if you want to continue hearing our podcasts in the future. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cucutier. The executive producer is Maz Ebtaj. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
This is The Guardian.
Any forward progress in technology involves some rational assumption of risk. And the way Google is thinking about that is, okay, how do we proceed both boldly and responsibly? Because the promise of these technologies is just so overwhelming.
Google's chief privacy officer, Keith Enright, talking about their approach to AI and privacy.
Take On Tomorrow from PwC's Strategy and Business. Available wherever you get your podcasts.